Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.
The illegal war in occupation of Iraq was waged for three reasons, according to the Bush administration. First, for weapons of mass destruction, which have yet to be found. Second, because the regime of Saddam Hussein had links to Al-Qaeda, which have never been proven. The third reason, embedded in the very name of the invasion, Operation Iraqi Freedom, was to liberate the Iraqi people. The upcoming January 30th Iraq election is the next step in this supposed attempt to bring democracy to Iraq. To discuss Iraq's election, we've contacted Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written a talking points about the Iraq election. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, good to be with you, Chris.
Maybe you can begin by explaining what the practical goals and purposes of the Iraq election are.
Well, I think from the vantage point of the United States, it's designed to provide a veneer of political cover so that there will be this illusion that what the U.S. troops are doing in Iraq is bringing democracy. Of course, there has been no consultation with the people of Iraq whether they want foreign troops to remain, whether they want to run elections under conditions of military occupation, under conditions of war, under conditions where what they are supposed to be voting for is a national assembly whose job it will be to draft a new constitution and select a new government, all under the guns, if you will, of foreign military occupation. So there's a serious problem of lack of legitimacy of these elections. But ironically, it's precisely for being able to claim a kind of democracy that the Bush administration is so committed to having the elections and having them go forward on January 30th.
Now, the Palestinians are having their election tomorrow, and there are people occupied, as well as, if we look back, East Timor, under Indonesian occupation, also had a similar version. How are the Iraqi elections different from these other two examples?
Well, they're different in a number of ways. The United Nations itself has used the example of the elections in East Timor to show that there can be a precedent for what they would call legitimate elections held under military occupation. But they ignore the very significant differences. In 1999, elections were indeed held in East Timor under the Indonesian occupation. But it was not an election to choose a new government. It was a referendum on the question of whether Timorese wanted to remain part of Indonesia or whether they wanted to become independent. As we know, the violence massively escalated after the election when it became clear that 80% or more of the Timorese were desperately eager for independence. The Indonesian military supported a gang of militias to essentially raise Dili to the ground, the Timorese capital, and thousands died. It was a very grim scene. But the election itself was designed to find out the opinion of Indonesians under real international verification. There were thousands of international election observers from all over the world that were in Timor. This time in Iraq, there are going to be at least hundreds of foreign election observers, but none of them are actually going to be in Iraq. They're going to be observing, quote, the elections from Amman in neighboring Jordan because Iraq is deemed too dangerous for them. So we'll have absolutely no firsthand information about the election. Now, the Palestinian election for tomorrow is a very different situation. What is I should note one other thing that's, I think, important. The Timorese were not being asked to vote for a new government under the gun of Indonesian occupation. In Palestine, the situation differs in other ways. Their election will indeed face some challenges of legitimacy because of the occupation, but there is very widespread among views among a wide range of political beliefs in Palestine that these elections will have significant legitimacy. And the reason it has everything to do with the history of Palestine in recent years, that even under the conditions of military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem that's gone on since 1967, there has been a functioning civil society. There has been, since 1994, a parliamentary structure, not a very good one, not a very functional one, but at least the structures have been in place. And there is very much a consciousness of a national life, a national civil society that takes place under the conditions of occupation, but not controlled by it. And also significantly, while the level of violence caused by the occupation in Palestine remains very high, but it can't be compared to the level of full-scale warfare that now is going on in Iraq. So while there are some challenges to legitimacy in tomorrow's election in Palestine, I think that there's some hope that it will be seen by Palestinians, as well as by the international community, as legitimate. That's not going to be the case in Iraq. We've recently heard from a number of U.S. officials, as well as Iraqi government officials, saying that the elections have got to be postponed. The Iraqi president, in fact, Ghazi al-Yawar, wasn't quite prepared to say on his own, "I believe the elections should be postponed." But what he said was the next best thing. He said the United Nations election team should issue a finding that elections should be postponed, which is pretty close. A U.S. general just yesterday announced that, as he put it, only four of the provinces of Iraq's 18 provinces are too dangerous for elections to be held. What he didn't say until pressed was that those four include Baghdad, Mosul, Tikrit, and Fallujah. So while they may be only four of the 18 provinces, they represent probably 50% of the population of the country.
And I wanted to go into that a bit more around the kind of violence that we're seeing reports of daily, and the U.S. and the kind of interaction between the Iraq armed resistance and the U.S. and how that will affect the election.
Well, what we've seen is that there has been an increasing escalation in both the number, the level of violence, and the sophistication of the resistance operations. They are ranging from 50 to 100 daily. They are taking place in areas almost entirely aimed at Iraqis who are deemed collaborators with the U.S. occupation. That means Iraqi police trainees, Iraqi officers, Iraqi civilians on their way to work inside the so-called green zone, which is the U.S.-controlled high security zone where the U.S. military and diplomatic officials have their offices. So it's unfortunately Iraqi civilians in many cases, security officials in other cases, but mostly Iraqis that are paying the ultimate price for the resistance. But it's very clear that the resistance target remains the U.S. occupation and those who are deemed collaborators with it. That is on the rise. What we've seen, if you look at the period from the June so-called transfer of authority, where the U.S. Claimed that it was now transferring authority to an Iraqi interim government, the number of U.S. casualties skyrocketed as well. In the 3 months following that so-called transfer, U.S. casualties went from about 450 a month to over 750 a month, just in that three-month period. It's gone way higher since then. So the number of deaths is escalating. We know from the Johns Hopkins University report that was published in the Lancet Medical Journal in London that somewhere over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed as a result of the occupation and war, the majority of them from violence, the majority of those from attacks by U.S. forces and the response to them. So we're looking at a very violent period in Iraqi history, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse, and there's every indication that the elections, which are going to almost certainly be viewed by Iraqis as lacking in significant legitimacy, we should note that even leading Shia representatives in Iraq, who represent probably 55 to 60% of the Iraqi population and are expected to be by far the victors of the elections. Even leading Shia political actors of various sorts are claiming that the elections are not going to have legitimacy, and they are urging that they be delayed. Even though they're likely to win, they understand that it will be a Pyrrhic victory if they win an election in which the Sunnis, through combination of boycotts and the inability to get to the polls, simply don't participate and are therefore underrepresented or perhaps not represented at all. This is not going to be viewed as a great victory for the Shia. They will understand that it means the elections overall will not be considered legitimate.
You've mentioned the Shiite and Sunni communities. The Kurds will also play a role in the election. What will participation mean for them?
Well, it's a little hard to know. The two major Kurdish parties who have been around for years and have in recent years, they've gone through various periods of being allied with Saddam Hussein, at other periods allied with the United States. They have come back over and over again to ally themselves with the United States, despite the fact that the Kurds, over the years, going back to 30 or 40 years from now, since 30 or 40 years, have consistently been betrayed by the United States. Under Henry Kissinger, under George Bush Sr., over and over again, there has been an alliance made with the Kurds, and then they've been abandoned to their fate. And they've suffered a great deal. The two leading Kurdish parties, the KDP and the PUK, both have largely abandoned the official claim that they are looking for an independent Kurdish state. They are saying that they will participate in the elections, and they, at this moment, are looking towards the guarantee that was imposed on the rules set in place by Paul Bremer when he was the proconsul of Iraq, which said that in the run-up to the creation of a new constitution, that the Kurds essentially would have a veto over all parts of it, guaranteeing that they would keep their level of significant autonomy within a federal structure. Now, I think there's a great deal of unease among Kurdish leaders about whether that commitment will remain. After all, it was put in place not by Iraqi officials, but by the Americans, who were guaranteeing it on behalf of their favored group within Iraq, who were the Kurds. That could be reversed in a moment. So I think there's a great deal of unease among the Kurds. There's also indications there was a meeting in the United Nations in New York last week and then in Geneva, both centers of the United Nations, where a group of Kurdish leaders not affiliated with either of the two main parties came to the UN with what they said was 1.8 million signatures of Iraqi Kurds calling for an independent state and saying that nothing else would be acceptable. They said, we are not calling for a boycott of the elections, but we don't imagine that many people will participate in it. Whether that's an accurate assessment, I'm not sure, but it is interesting that the two leading Kurdish parties, who are largely unchallenged in the electoral arena, may in fact not have the level of support that they claim to have. It may be that a kind of Kurdish civil society that's emerged is now calling for a far more extreme solution for them, which is to secede, essentially, from Iraq altogether.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Let's turn to look at U.S. political influence inside the country. There are U.S. Operations, including the National Democratic Institute, that are aimed at influencing the election. Can you outline these influences?
Yeah, there's two major U.S. Institutions. One is NDI, as you said, the National Democratic Institution. The other is IRI, the same version, the International Republican Institute. IIR, I think it is, the International Institute of Republic, something like that. I forget exactly the name. But both of these are linked through the through U.S. funding to the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a Cold War era institution established essentially to take over what had been done earlier by the CIA and had been largely discredited, ostensibly independent of the government. Ostensibly, the Republican and Democratic NDI and their Republican counterparts are independent of the government, although most of their funding comes from the government. And they are there ostensibly providing things like training for elections, campaign, how to run a political campaign, all the things that sound very nonpartisan, let's say. But the reality is, of course, that they are making that training, those things, available only to the parties that they choose. So the question of who has the benefit of them is by far something that is left to the choice of Americans. We should also note that with the so-called transfer of power back in June, one of the things that did not change was the level of influence of the United States on the Iraqi interim government, to the extent that there are over 200 Americans who are seconded to various Iraqi ministries. Every ministry in Iraq that is supposedly independent under this notion that there is in place an interim independent government, every ministry has one or more very powerful U.S. officials that are supposed to act as an aide to the minister. Now, in theory, every minister has the right to say yes or no to any suggestion or any advice that he or she may get from the U.S. Assistance, as it were. But the reality is, when the U.S. still controls all the money, the idea that any Iraqi interim minister would challenge the view of their U.S., quote, assistant, really, you know, it boggles the mind. That certainly is just not going to happen. So there are Americans who are still calling the shots within the Iraqi ministries themselves.
I guess we don't know how an elected or, you know, so-called elected Iraqi assembly government will respond to the U.S. at this point, but what would you expect?
Well, I don't think we know for sure. What we do know is that the leading Shia party, which is it's not a party, a coalition of parties, in which the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani is the leading figure, although he's, of course, not running for office himself, but it's people responsible to him who are the leading candidates in that coalition, they are likely to win the largest amount of votes. Now, in their official platform, they call for setting a date certain for the withdrawal of foreign troops. What that means if they win, I think, is quite problematic. I think there's a view that says that it would actually be, we should go ahead with the elections. It would be a great thing because then Sistani and his people will win and they'll demand that the U.S. leave. The problem with that is, number one, I don't think we know what Sistani and his people will actually call for if they take power, because anyone who takes power under the terms of this election, an election held under military occupation, is going to be dependent on the U.S. troops, U.S. training of Iraqi troops, et cetera, to stay in power, absent their own power, which doesn't exist on a military level. So whether they, in fact, call for an immediate withdrawal of the U.S. troops, I think, is quite problematic. We also don't know what the U.S. answer would be. Despite all of the rhetoric that we've heard for so long from Colin Powell, from President Bush, all along, that we are here to help the Iraqi people, and when they want us to leave, we will leave. Well, we'll see. We'll just see whether the views of even an Iraqi government calling for an end to the U.S. occupation would lead to an end to that occupation. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what the results are going to be of this election.
Looking at this from an activist perspective, what would it mean for the international peace and anti-war movements if a new Iraqi assembly actually complied with the U.S. occupation and accepted it?
Well, I think that we have to recognize that people in Iraq have suffered an enormous amount, and the views of Iraqis are many and varied. I think there are many Iraqis who may well come out of this believing that their best option is to have the U.S. troops remain because they'll be safer that way. I don't happen to agree with that, but I can understand why Iraqis would say that. However, from the standpoint of the international community, we have to be governed by international law. The fact that some Iraqis, or even most Iraqis, may say we want an illegal occupation to remain in our country doesn't mean we can support that. Our foundation is international law, and international law says, as Kofi Annan said not too long ago, the U.S. occupation in Iraq, the U.S. war in Iraq, is illegal. It was illegal when they invaded. It's illegal now. And I think that has to be the basis of our opposition. We should take note of what Iraqis say. We should be very concerned about the rights of Iraqis. But for one thing, I don't think that we can believe that the opinions that emerge from any particular poll, any election, necessarily reflect all Iraqis. And secondly, our accountability is not to Iraqi public opinion. It's to international law.
Well, thank you very much, Phyllis, for taking the time to be with us today.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.